Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Good morning there, Marky.
Good morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm great, man.
You know, there was an article recently in the New York Times Magazine that I know that you saw because we touched on it briefly, but I wanted to talk about it today. And it's...
Well, you and I debated it already, but we can debate it some more.
No, it's not really a debate. I think we largely agree. And the article is entitled, it's a sort of a fluff piece by Alexander Jacobs. It's called Table Tots, Whatever Happened to Adults Only Dinner Parties. And I'll read just a little bit from it. My daughter Josephine recently attended her first grown-up dinner party. The lights were low, the company was sophisticated, the music was jazz, and my daughter had a sparkling debut. Indeed, she was the hit of the night, lying quietly at the end of the table, wrapped in a hospital blanket like a burrito. She was less than a week old. Totally for that. You want to bring your one-week-old, and the deal is, they become fussy, you got to go, okay, when you go to somebody else's dinner party.
Well, that's, I think, when you go to a dinner party or, frankly, to a fine dining restaurant, you can bring your under one-year-old as long as you're willing to get up and...
If they start screaming.
Because, frankly, kids that age sleep a lot.
Right.
I mean, I've had people bring in six-month-olds into the restaurant, and they just sleep the whole dinner away, and their parents have a real nice night out.
Well, here we go on, though, with the article by Alexander Jacobs, and she says, she talks about her one-week-old was very good, not so the imperious little hellion of a two-and-a-half-year-old.
Hellion. I haven't been called a hellion in so long.
Who bounded out from her spot before a Dora the Explorer video and demanded to be seated at the head of our table of 10 adults. Her mother smiled helplessly, perhaps not wishing to incite an even more embarrassing tantrum. Leaving yours truly squatting awkwardly on a quarter ottoman, a hostess's lot. Later in the evening, I cringed as the toddler teetered out near our glass-topped rectangular coffee table. The quote from the mom is, "Oh, she's all right," the mother said with that special mom spidey sense. No, she's not.
Well, the thing that you should realize as a parent is your house may be childproof, but almost nobody who has children's house is, unless they're a grandparent.
Come to Francis's house.
where he keeps his cognac at knee level, so beware.
Excuse me, Sonny, that bric-a-brac is a rare Persian, anyway. But, it talks about how things change. And here she says, the article goes on, I thought it was very interesting. It says, in earlier generations, by all accounts, children my generation, that's for sure, were seen and not heard, fed early in the night of a dinner party, and tucked away before company came, perhaps creeping down for a peep at the party, which I did, or even getting a canapé or two if they were well-behaved about it.
Through the railing at the staircase. You were allowed to sit at the stairs silently
and watch adults.
And watch from through the railings of the staircase for about 7 minutes, and then you were shooed back upstairs.
That still goes on, and that goes on among our friends, and I really do like when our friends say, and I remember when our friends Anthony and Teresa, the first year of the Christmas party, I mean, our Christmas party we've been having since we were 25, 22, 21, some 21, oh my God, 21 years old, and the Christmas party went from a, you know, college kids thing, mm-hmm, to a young professionals thing, to for a while there, everybody brought their kids, and there were kids all over the place thing, and now the people's kids are 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old.
Well, and now everybody has 2, 3, 4 kids. 4 kids would be me. Now that everybody has multiple kids, it's not 2 kids, 3 kids, 4 kids. It would be 40 or 50 kids.
But also, people have said, okay, we do a lot with our kids. And there are dinner parties. I mean, you have dinner all the time, and I go to dinners all the time, where the kids are over and the kids can play together and the adults sit at the table. And I think that's great. But the first
year... It's a separate event. It's different than having an adult dinner party.
But the first year, they made it an adults-only. They put that on the invitation. Mm-hmm. Hey, everybody, this year, it's an adult-only party. And I think there's a time and a place for that, you know? Here she goes on to write about, I think... where she says, there's a whole new sect of parent who doesn't believe in discipline, that just letting them run wild is the thing to do. I agree. In your house alone with your kid, super. Don't invite me over. And
right.
Don't come over my house with your running wild kid.
But I'm your guest and should be treated that way. And I think that there's some of this is lost, and I don't know what the issue is, but the whole, when you welcome someone into your house, that you are supposed to be taking care of them, that they're supposed to be made to feel comfortable. And if three of your kids are running around the house, you know, playing with the Dora the Explorer doll, or the Wiggles car goes between my feet singing at me as it goes, I may not be as comfortable as I should be when I'm a guest in your home.
And that's different from when I stop by for a cup of coffee or you say, hey, why don't you come over and have dinner with the family on
Tuesday? And what we're talking about are two different nights, two different occasions, two different types of party.
And I think that it's very clear to talk about what kind of party that you're having, and it's very important. And one of the things that's changed is people would assume that if you were invited to, in the last generation, if you were invited to someone's house for dinner as an adult and your kids weren't expressly invited, that they weren't invited.
Right.
And you would assume that it would be an adult evening unless it said, you know, bring the whole family, which was a whole different thing. And now what they're saying is as the etiquette has changed and as things have evolved, What Alexander Jacobs says in this article, and I agree, I'm in favor of hosts or hostesses making themselves perfectly clear on the point from the outset. Otherwise, they risk welcoming mini-me's when they're not appropriate. Attention, Hallmark, here's a new twist to the RSVP, already making its appearance on some Gotham invitations. Here's one. This is a quote from an invitation. Please consider putting the children and your other concerns to bed early and joining us for a few hours of grown-up revelry. I like that. But people are not always so polite about it. One childless couple in Cobble Hill, Brooklyn, put on their invitation that was received recently. This is a no dogs, no kids party. Thank you for your cooperation. I think that's a little rude, but
It's funny that you say that. But you know, I know people who bring their dogs to parties.
Yeah.
Okay, you're having an outdoor barbecue or whatever, and you're having 40 or 50 people in your backyard, and they bring their dog.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Yeah, that's kind of rude.
What? You know, I think 10 times ruder than bringing your kid is bringing your dog.
Well, but you can't make the kid stand outside in the porch in the winter. the dog. You can't tie the kid up to a rail. But you know, no, I know. I've experienced that as well, and I've experienced people who people treat their pets differently. And I really love dogs, and I
have a dog, but don't bring yours. I shut mine up in the bedroom for the party for a reason.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and the other side of this article, the thing that it says is, you know, a lot of parents just can't go to dinner parties that often because they have kids and they can't get a sitter. Well,
I'm one of those parents who, you know, for my wife and I to get out at the same time for a dinner party is difficult. We have four kids, including one infant, and it's difficult sometimes, and sometimes we can't go.
But what this other person said in the article, they quoted one person who said, listen, I want to go to bed at 9 anyway. It's the best excuse ever that I can ever have is, yeah, I can't get a sitter. But again, don't take this the wrong way. I'm totally pro kid, you know, and I think I have a lot of fun with my friends and knowing my friends' kids, and then, you know, Uncle Francis. That's amazing.
I just think that's a lost thing, the adult only dinner party,
cocktail party,
where in a person's home, because we all go out to restaurants with adults only, but in a person's home, the adult only party. It's not just for people who are over 50.
Yeah, no, it's true, and it's a totally different dynamic. It's a totally different dynamic. Hey, when we come back, we'll be talking with Anthony Bourdain, one of the most controversial and interesting chefs, writers in America, and also host of his television show No Reservations. Back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Everybody knows Anthony Bourdain, executive chef at Les Halles, author of several books, including the wonderful Kitchen Confidential, host of his own television series, No Reservations. His latest book is called The Nasty Bits, Collected and Varietal Cuts, Usable Trims, Scraps, and Bones. In the book, we follow Bourdain through his worldwide food adventures and into unusual food territory. We read about his strongly held views on everything from dissecting and eating a raw, freshly caught seal organs with an Inuit family on their kitchen floor, on the one hand, to vegetarianism, raw food, and Woody Harrelson on the other. He's for the first and against the second. Hey, Anthony.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Welcome to the show, Anthony.
Thanks.
So what do you got against Woody Harrelson, man?
Well, Woody was the, while we do share a taste for some things, you know, there was an anecdote in the introduction to Charlie Trotter and Roxanne Klein's book, Raw, that describes stumbling upon Woody Harrelson in Thailand, at a cafe. And here he is in Thailand eating the same raw, like avocado salad every single day. And just the notion to me of having, you know, some overriding, arbitrary, non-religious philosophy of eating.
Now, his philosophy is he's a raw foodist, right?
That raw, yeah, it leads to clean colon and groovy purity and unblocked energy centers, and I really don't fully understand.
You know what? I think I want my energy centers blocked.
Yeah. but the idea, the notion that you could be in, you know, you're lucky enough to find yourself in Thailand, one of the countries with the oldest and most varied and vibrant, fantastic food cultures on the planet, and just eat this, you know, joyless sort of regime, you know, to not be curious or polite enough to sample what's available in a place like Thailand. I think it's symptomatic of a larger kind of Puritanesque ethic, and I just found it deeply, deeply terrifying.
Eating for sustenance instead of fun is not my way to live.
It's worse than sustenance. It's eating for some kind of, you know, weird Hollywood worldview, and you know, I think it should be nipped in the bud.
You know, I think what's interesting. I mean, you're a complex guy, Anthony, and you have strongly held opinions, and you can't always predict where your opinions are going to come out. And I think that's one of the things that people really like about watching you and reading you. Now, Roxanne Klein, who with Charlie Trotter wrote this book Raw. Roxanne Klein also is opened with her husband a raw food restaurant years later in Larkspur, where we dined, had one of the best meals of our lives.
Yeah.
And you make a pretty good discussion in your book about how, you know, the Puritanism of being in Thailand and being only a raw foodist, you know, you have the problems that you just spoke about with them, and Mark and I probably agree. But at the same time, you look at the book and say, wow, these dishes are really amazing. And
yeah, they look just like food, don't they?
Yeah.
And look at the expense. First of all, the amount of that stuff you have to get into your system to have any kind of, to live is unbelievable. Someone did a cost breakdown on what it would take. So you need to be fantastically wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of time, you need dehydrators and all of this, you know, equipment. I mean, how is that natural? We're designed, our bodies are designed to sit around fires and roast meat products, smaller, stupider creatures, and eat them and tear them apart with our teeth. But I think the thing that really enrages me is that food has led me again and again to the richest experiences of my life, which is to say that food is a reflection of a people and a culture and a history. And to shut yourself off from that because you're concerned about your colon just seems wrong.
You know, I want to share, you know, I'm going to get myself in trouble now. I'm going to share.
So this will be different from yesterday.
I have had a few relationships in my life. I've had maybe three or four significant relationships in my life. I'm 40 years old. And three of them have been with vegetarians. It must be like a weird pheromone that I emit because I'm the biggest carnivore you can imagine. But one of the most difficult things for me about dating a vegetarian, now look, if you're in San Francisco, it's fine. If you're in New York, it's sort of okay. But to be in another place and have, you know, I'm a foodie, right? So you have a chef or a winemaker or someone from the area say, why don't you come back to my house for dinner?
Right.
How do you say, sure, except that my girlfriend only eats this and won't eat that and doesn't eat this? You know, which, you know, it blocks you off from a whole part of
culture. How do you take them out? You know, it's, you go to a really good restaurant. I mean, how do you walk into a great restaurant and they order the tasting menu and then, you know, something for Bugs Bunny over here.
Corn chips and salsa.
I will tell you my most shameful, horrible secret is I actually went out briefly with a vegetarian, too.
But, you know, it's a mixed marriage.
She broke fast for sushi every now and again, which I appreciated.
It's a mixed marriage, man. It's the kind that never works.
We had a vegetarian who worked for us for a while and eventually became our maitre d', and by the end of it, she was eating sausage and foie gras. So.
Yeah, they all want bacon. Just, you know, you can always get them with the bacon.
And now, hold on a second.
Eat them liquor and let them smell bacon cooking.
You're an evil man, but I'm starting to like you. You know, we got only 1 minute left in this segment, but we'll come back and talk about it in the next. You talk about, we've talked a lot about this recent foie gras controversy and that foie gras has been made illegal in Chicago. You have a chapter in your book dealing with that. Can you sort of intro it and we'll make a break, we'll come back and talk more about it?
Well, I think the PETA people wisely picked on an issue that they could win because so few people actually eat it. It's seen as, cruel food for a few rich people to enjoy. And they got in at the right time and right place, and here we go. You know, centuries of culinary, fundamental culinary tradition and ingredient is now going to be illegal in Chicago.
All right, I'm going to come back and we're going to talk more about what happened in the incident you write about in your book. You got one. I'm going to ask you a pointed question. Next life, you're coming back as a bird. You want to come back as a foie gras duck or a McNugget chicken?
You got it.
Which are you coming back as?
I would rather be a foie gras duck.
Me too. I'm
absolutely.
My liver's kind of fat as it is, and I'm a human being. We'll be back in just a moment talking more with Anthony Bourdain about his new book, The Nasty Bits, Collected Varietal Cuts, Usable Trims, Scraps, and Bones. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagat and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standard set by Kathleen Lombardi. You see, Kathleen Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or KatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. And Frank, you're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left. Guest is Jersey Boy, Anthony Bourdain. His book is The Nasty Bits. We were talking about the foie gras controversy. Now, you call the people who... Why don't you tell people about what happened in Sonoma?
In Sonoma, a good friend of mine, Laurent Manrique, who's a proud Gascon who goes back many years.
Gascon is where foie gras comes from originally.
Yeah. And here he opened a little gourmet shop that, among other products, he was going to sell foie gras. These animal rights terrorists broke into the place, completely trashed the business, threatened his customers, and then worst of all, while he was at work, slipped into his backyard and at night and surreptitiously videotaped his wife cuddling his newborn child.
Awful.
And sent him the videotape with a sinister, threatening voiceover.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think those people should be rewarded, and that's what's happening. I mean, they're passing laws. They're getting their way.
Yeah.
And that kind of... You know, Puritan, again, this fundamentalist, joyless, philosophy of, you know, food, that it's wrong for you to eat that. It's just horrifying. And it's gutless that they're picking on chefs. You know, they're terrorizing chefs. You know, go to inner city Oakland and try to break up a cockfight or a dog fight. You know, if you're so committed, you know, I'd like to see them, instead of wheeling down in their SUVs over to Sonoma, down the street, where mommy and daddy can bail them out if they get into trouble. You know, hey, go to Burma and, bust up some, start dealing with organized gangs who are, you know, going after exotic animal parts for medicine. I mean, in the spectrum of cruelty, it's so low.
But you can't even call them Puritan because now they're going into someone's house and criminally threatening them. It's just awful. Awful that a duck would be higher in the pecking order, no pun intended,
or equivalent,
than a person.
There are hundreds of thousands of people being, mutilated, sold literally into slavery, you know, starving all over the world as I travel. I mean, places where people live in poverty, animals live in unbelievable conditions. You know, as I've often said, I have friends who are very active in this kind of animal cruelty thing. And I've suggested, listen, put your money where your mouth is. Buy, raise a couple of $100 million to buy Viagra for the Far East. Well, and a lot of these animals will live a richer, longer, more fruitful lives. The real extreme animal cruelty is directly related to anxiety about the coinage.
We have to take a break for the news. We'll come back in just a moment talking with Anthony Bourdain about his new book. And I will tell you again that if these animal rights rescue people want to go and do some good, they should go for the McDonald's chicken because that's treated much worse than your foie gras duck. And that just shows the hypocrisy of the whole thing. We agree with you. Back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back.
You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Our guest today is Anthony Bourdain. Everybody knows Anthony Bourdain, especially if you're from New Jersey. He's the executive chef at Les Halles. He's author of many books, including Kitchen Confidential, his own television series called No Reservations, and his latest book is The Nasty Bits. Anthony, we were talking before the show about different ways that people source food. And in your book, you're always, as a chef needs to be, talking about how the taste comes first and how people need to be open to different tastes and working with the best quality. You make some controversial statements, though, about does a chef have a responsibility to buy sustainably or to avoid things that might be endangered? Do you think a chef or a consumer, for that matter, has any responsibility in those areas?
I think that's that's up to every, just as in every other part of our lives, I think that's an individual decision to what extent you want to be socially responsible. That's up to the individual conscience. As a profession, I think, speaking generally, I think chefs' only obligation is to provide pleasure. That we're in the pleasure business. Is it good? Is all we should care about as a profession. I think, personally, I mean, if swordfish is wildly overfished, I'll lay off the swordfish. If it's an endangered species, I'll lay off it. But if somebody offers me the last, kilo of beluga caviar on the planet, and it's already in the can, hey, I'm taking it. I've had ortolan. It's not endangered, but it's illegal.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a responsible balance that should be up to every individual chef's conscience.
Do you think the governments have a right to step in and say, okay, we're going to protect this species now and you can't have it, or do you think they should lay off?
I think in some cases they're absolutely right. They've got to do something about codfish, for instance, which are disappearing. I think there's a role for government. I think where I really differ with the government was when they won't let me eat good cheese.
Yeah.
We'll
talk to people about that. I don't think people understand that issue. I mean, we're 100% in agreement there. Well, tell people why you can't get good cheese in America.
Well, because they will not allow raw milk, unaged raw milk, unpasteurized cheese. And we are designed to our bodies crave and like a certain amount of bacteria. We're designed to eat that stuff. That's the good stuff that they eat in Europe and have eaten for centuries and made in an artisanal way. This tendency to feel that the state owes you absolutely clean, bacteria-free, 100% safe, and politically correct food is a really destructive one.
We actually know as a fact that the more of those kinds of foods you eat, the more immune you become to those bacteria.
Yeah, if we live in a hygienic bubble all the time, eating nothing but processed food, if we step outside the country, we're going to drop dead.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny actually. We had Dr. Ron Schmid, who's a doctor. You can go to our website and restaurantguysradio.com, and we deal with the whole issue of raw milk. It's really crazy that you can't get raw milk and cheese in this country, and it's very good for you, but it's also the best tasting.
We cook all the life out of our milk before we drink it.
And you're even more likely to get ill from processed cheese. And once again, absolute safety means absolute freedom from pleasure.
It's sterile. And it's sterile in every sense of the word. It works on multiple levels. Hey, can I turn the conversation for a moment to television chefs? I mean, you've got your own show, so you're quite the perfect man to talk to about this. In your book, you have no problem with celebrity chefdom or gastropreneurs overall, but you juxtapose two stories in your book. You talk about the sort of Rocco DiSpirito going down in flames flirtation with television, and Emeril's great success with television.
And I think that's really well done.
And I thought that was really very interesting. Would you talk to our audience about the distinctions you draw?
Well, I think it's an almost a Greek tragedy, Icarus flying too close to the sun. I think Rocco just forgot, why he got famous in the first place. He forgot who he was. He thought he was going to, I don't know whether he thought he was going to be an actor or just wanted to be a celebrity more than he wanted to cook. The tragedy of it is that Rocco DiSpirito is really one of the most talented cooks, one of the most talented cooks and chefs in New York. I mean, hugely respected for his ability. And, I think chefs who start talking about themselves in the third person or falling too in love with their image on TV, they forget and forget who they are, that's the fatal flaw.
Yeah.
Emerald,
who I loathed, you know, I mean, I hate that show. Mm-hmm. You know, over the passage of time, I've realized, you know, listen, the guy, if anybody deserves to be famous, it's him. I mean, it's not like he didn't put in the work. He's a successful, unlike Rocco, he has a number of successful restaurants that are well-run businesses that serve good food, and he employs a lot of people, and well, as I understand it.
I think the worst part of the whole Rocco situation is that now he's not cooking in any kitchens, and we're not tasting his food.
Yeah, great cook.
And he was great as a cook and great as a chef when he was running Union Pacific. He cooked me a 21-course dinner once that was incredible.
One of the best meals of my life.
And I think, though, that also you need to be very – there's a cautionary tale there if you're in the food business, because I think that the goals of the network in that show were opposite of Rocco's goal. And there became a point at which it became – in their interest for you to watch a train wreck because it kept.
That's what it was. It was sort of like a Simple Life. It's you're humiliating yourself deliberately. You're complicit in your own humiliation. That's what people want to see.
Yeah.
You know, you want to be. You know, do you really? You want to be on television so bad that you'll go in the real world and, you know, get urinated on by a naked mini me? You know, or live in a house with a bunch of like D-lists? I mean, well, why? Get an honorable job like sticking up liquor stores or something. I mean, does anyone emerge with a career after those shows?
But
I mean,
I gotta stand up for Rocco though. I mean, I think that Colicchio now in his Top Chef thing is doing a great role there, and he was very cautious about how
he's perceived. He's perceived as the head judge,
and he was very careful about the role that he chose there. But I think Rocco got suckered into that, and I think there was some editing there that made him look worse than.
They clearly edited it to make him look like the bad guy. And I mean, I'd heard him quoted elsewhere as saying he wanted to do the second season because he wanted to correct the bad impression he had in the first. He'd left in the first season. Well, that's not what the business they're in.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think. Not caring, really, is probably, well, never doing reality shows is always a good policy. and just not caring too much about how you come off on TV. Once you start to care, you kind of careen over to the dark side.
Well, let's go back to restaurants for a moment or two. Your chapter on counterculture, and you talk about fancy restaurants and how maybe fancy restaurants have gotten a little too fancy, and someone walking you all the way to the men's room, into the stall. And I thought that was great. Will you talk to us about that?
Please don't pull out a toilet paper roll for me.
Yeah.
I'm fine. I'll be in here. You go back.
Yeah, I really don't need it announced loudly to the dining room. You know, come right this way. Yes, the bathroom is right this way, sir. You know, I'd like to sneak off subtly, you know.
Have restaurants gotten too fussy?
I think there are some. I think, in fact, there's a tendency now, I think largely because chefs are suffering from fine dining exhaustion. And some of the best meals we have, as I'm sure you know, mm-hmm. are after work at very simple places or, you know, like in Spain. People who go to Spain and see how relaxed an atmosphere you can eat great food. I think are saying, do I really need, you know, all that glassware, all that formality, all the nonsense? You know, there are plenty of exceptions. You know, I think there are restaurants like Per Se where you expect and want that, and it's done with a casual elegance that hits just the right note.
Mm-hmm.
But I think stuffiness, pomposity, pretense, does that make food taste better? I don't think so.
The trend that's really bugging me lately is the pocketbook rest where they bring over the little stool for you to put your pocketbook down on.
I mean, do I need a water sommelier? I really think that's...
You wrote about that in your book. What restaurant were you in where they brought over the water cart with a bunch of different waters?
That was Ducasse, New York.
Oh, God.
And I don't need to make a decision from among 20 bottles of water, and I don't want to hear about them.
You know what? I'm kind of a fusspot myself. But it's funny because you can get into, in some of these places when they go over the top, you wind up talking to your waiter about all these different decisions throughout the course of the meal, and I think to myself, I came here so you would make all the decisions for me.
Right,
just be me.
I want to stop thinking.
Just
yeah.
be me.
It's why I order the tasting menu, so you'll stop talking to me.
Cooking is a dominant act. It's all about control. Eating well should be, at its best, should be submissive. You mm-hmm. walk into the place and say, just feed me.
Yeah.
You're good, right? Give me the good stuff.
You know what? And even in these fancy restaurants, I find the way to short-circuit all this, and I'm sure that you do the same thing, whether you have a friend in the kitchen or not. You walk in and say, let the chef cook for us. I'm allergic to nuts, and then go.
Yeah, give me your best game.
I often want to say to the water sommelier, I think my response would be, shh, shh, pour me some water, shh. No more talking. We'll be back in just a moment. Our guest is Anthony Bourdain. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Economy Paper and Restaurant Supply Company is the oldest dealership in New Jersey. They've been equipping and supplying restaurants since 1932, and they know that to make great food, you need great equipment. You need equipment that doesn't break down, and you can't pay too much for it. Whether you need an emergency replacement or a wholesale kitchen renovation, Economy's knowledge, experience, and integrity are indispensable. Economy Paper and Restaurant Supply is a recognized dealer for all major brands, and they specialize in custom fabrication and ventilation. At Economy, they've got all the tools you need to get the job done, all in one place, all priced right, and delivered to your door. Economy is the only dealer in New Jersey that's been approved for on-site demonstrations of the Rational Combi Oven. The Rational Combi Oven is an innovative combination of convection and adjustable steam oven. It's a powerful and versatile tool in your kitchen's arsenal. They also supply competitively priced paper products and all the non-food supplies every restaurant needs. You can visit the Economy Demo Kitchen on Broad Street in Clifton, New Jersey. You can also visit economysupply.com, then call them at 973-279-5500. That's 973-279-5500.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left in Castle Lombardi Restaurant in New Jersey. Our guest today is Anthony Bourdain. I don't need to tell you who he is, because if you don't know, well, on Bible somewhere. He's from New Jersey originally, and he's back here on our show today. We're talking about fancy restaurants, but you also mentioned, Anthony, in the last segment, you mentioned Spain as a place where real foodies are going today.
Yeah.
I love Spain, and I've had a romance with Spain for many years, and I'm going to invite you to talk about it in general, but I got to say, the Anthony Bourdain bullfighting book would be right in line with your other stuff. When's it coming out?
Oh yeah, I don't know. You eat the bull at the end, right?
Yeah, you eat the you know what's done with those bulls, by the way?
Oh yeah.
Well, of course you do. You're Anthony Bourdain, but no, the audience might not. The tail of the fighting bull soup, which, you know, it's funny. There are only three bulls in a match,
right?
And like 1,000 restaurants around the bull ring all have tail of fighting bull soup.
Yep.
Yeah. How do they all get that? I think it's all not from the fighting.
Well, occasionally you get tail of the fighting cow soup.
But what you don't know is that, or what many people don't know is that those bulls are automatic. They're butchered right there on site, right outside the ring, and they're usually given to orphanages and churches and charities.
Yeah.
Wild stuff. So talk to me about Spain.
I love that. You know, it's a grown up culture of you know, fantastic tapas bars. You can either bounce from one place to another, nibbling what's good at each place, or you can go out to dinner at midnight. It's casual. You eat standing up, you eat sitting down. It's very straightforward, very ingredient based. It's one of the really exciting places to eat on earth, and it's where the chefs are going for inspiration there, and also I think Singapore and Kuala Lumpur as well, because of their hawker stand street food cultures, which is also turning a lot of chefs on, that you could eat something really, really good, really exciting, authentic, you know, right on the street.
Besides an old pretzel?
Yeah.
Well, now make a distinction, please, because you do in your book, and I think it's very important, that Spain is at the top of the pack with Ferran Adrià at Il Bulli for
right.
what we call avant-garde cuisine, you know, very
yeah.
experimental cuisine. But, you know, that's, you know, to me, there are too many foams in my life right now.
Yeah,
there
are a lot of pretenders out there
in
this world.
You know, just because you like Jimi Hendrix doesn't mean you should try to play guitar like Jimi
Hendrix. Right. Maybe you should be James Taylor, you know?
Right. And I think what people forget about Ferran, especially his imitators, is that essentially he's a Catalonian Spanish chef, and his food, unlike so much of this foam nonsense, it's always very Spanish. Mm-hmm. And here's a guy who loves simple food, who's just expressing it in very, very complex ways. You know, it's just one of those, you know, he's Ferran Adrià, chances are you're not. You know?
You know, I have to say, though, with food like Adrià's, I think it's interesting. I don't think Ferran Adrià, and there are many books where people go and they talk with Ferran Adrià, he doesn't eat that way every night. That's
no, his favorite restaurant in the world is this simple place a few miles from his restaurant, where it's a mom and pop joint with a griddle, where yeah. everything is seafood, really good seafood, grilled up a la plancha, a little olive oil and sea salt.
I always think it's funny when one of my customers will see me in like a pizzeria or something and be like, you're eating pizza?
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, yes, I eat pizza, and I love it. Okay?
Once a year, I don't eat foie gras. I only eat pizza.
I'm really embarrassed, like, if I'm drunk 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'm stumbling out of KFC with a bag of chicken wings, and somebody says, oh, Anthony, I love your show. And I'm like, oh, I want to put a bag over my head, and not a KFC bag.
Right, exactly.
So now I want to just delve on it in a slightly different subject for one second. Now, throughout your books, throughout your career, it seems like you've kind of vacillated between this reverence for the business and reverence for the things that we do and irreverence for some of the things that we do and some of the – is it smoke and mirrors or is it the real deal? Is it magic?
I love the business. Okay, I was a hopeless restaurant addict. I'm one of those people who likes it crazy. That's why I was in it. I love the people in it. I like being part of it. Happiest years of my life, worst years of my life, but I don't regret, a minute of it. And, when I wrote Kitchen Confidential, I thought I was writing it for, a few other line cooks and restaurant people in New York City. Those were the only people I thought would buy such a book. I had no idea what was going to happen.
I got to say, with Kitchen Confidential, everybody I know in the business read it voraciously. Everybody
Absolutely.
Who wasn't in the business read it and said, is that what the business is really like? And the answer, of course, is, well yeah.
and sometimes.
And everybody who didn't read the – and everybody who read the book who was in the business was like, oh, I met a guy like that. Yeah,
yep.
I know that guy. That line cook, I got him. Smoking pot in the walk-in. I know him. So you like an edge in your life. And this book, which we've hardly talked about at all, but you can go to our website. We've read it, and we got an advanced copy of it. And you can go to our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and learn how to buy it for yourself because you should pick it up. You talk a lot about the passing of old New York. Sleaze Gone By, I think, is the name of the chapter. And as New York's become cleaner and friendlier, it's lost a little of its edge. You want to talk about that at all?
Well, my first job in New York was as a bicycle messenger when I was like 14, 15 years old. And, hey, happy times, 18 was the drinking age, they'd mm-hmm. serve you as long as you were over 14, they had the grind houses on, where you could watch a great triple bill on 42nd Street. I mean, there was a sense of character. I feel as a New Yorker that we should be scarier than the tourists who visit us. And that's just not the case anymore. Times Square used to be kind of frightening, and I was proud of that.
Now it's Disneyland, yeah. New Yorkers used to have the rep that, you're from New York. And now it's like, yeah, you're from New York. What's the difference? You're from Disneyland. You know what I mean? It's like it's lost some of its edge. But that seems to be a common theme for you in restaurants and food in your whole life, that you're looking for that edge.
But I got to tell you, traveling the world, I see a lot of, soft, beautiful edges as well. So, maybe I'm changing a little in that regard. I mean, when you've been to, Southeast Asia as much as I have, when you've been to Vietnam, Indonesia, there's something to be said for, a rice-growing community, a fishing village.
Anthony, I'm getting older and softer, too.
Yeah, we're going to have to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. Our guest is Anthony Bourdain. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1155. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. My friend Francis of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants. Our guest is Anthony Bourdain. His new book is called The Nasty Bits, Collected and Varietal Cuts, Usable Trims, Scraps and Bones. You can find it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Anthony, another thing that runs throughout a lot of many of your books about food and also is in your chapter in this book, When the Cooking is Over, Turn Out the Lights, Turn Out the Lights. You talk about the connection between cooking, music, and sex. Does all food lead to sex?
Let's hope so.
All good food, anyway.
If you're not interested in sex, you there's no way you can cook. I think it's our responsibility as people in the pleasure business to fully understand our subject.
Uh-huh. So that's all research you're doing out there. That's not...
Research, exactly.
That would make everything pretty much tax-deductible now, wouldn't it?
I think it's important. People who like good music and eaters.
I agree. And I also think that the business, because it's nocturnal, I find nocturnal people more interesting, and I find that one of the things about this show is that a lot of people listen because Mark and I are leaving work at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning or going out for drinks in New York at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, and people sort of like to hear what's going on because most people know people are asleep at 1 o'clock in the morning.
Well, you're out with people like yourself, free, add you know, a sort of degenerate subculture, late hours and free alcohol, you know, that spells party.
Yeah, actually it does.
And not to mention the fact that there is an adrenaline rush from this business and an emotional charge that comes from being in this business at the pace we work.
God, I miss that.
You know, I got to tell you also, if I go to, because I've always worked nights my whole life, that if I go to bed before 11 o'clock, I feel like I'm being punished.
I cannot fall asleep before midnight. No matter what happens.
Anthony, thanks for coming on the show. You've been great.
It was fun. I could do it all day with you guys.
Thanks very much, Anthony.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.
The book, the most recent book, Kitchen Confidential, if you haven't read it, you have to pick up Kitchen Confidential as well. But the latest book is called The Nasty Bits. It's really great. You want to find out more about it, come to our website, restaurantguysradio.com.
Kitchen Confidential, one of those books that actually changed the topography of the way people viewed restaurants, and frankly, the way I think some restaurant owners viewed the way that they were being seen.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed the hour with the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.